Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly call. Today is Monday, May 4th, 2026. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're listening in over Rumble or YouTube and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us live by phone, app, or browser. If anybody would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions@nationallibertyalliance.org. That's plural, questions. We also have Bible studies every Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. Here in this start meeting room. This week's study is on the abomination of desolation. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right side of the website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on the donation tab on the top right side of the website. Okay, we're going to start with our scripture reading tonight. We're going to be looking at Romans chapter 5, read by Alexander Scorby. Let me see if I can pull that up. Chapter 5. Okay, read by Alexander Scorby.
Chapter 5. Therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom also we have access by faith into this grace wherein we stand and rejoice in hope of the glory of God. And not only so, but we glory in tribulations also, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope. And hope maketh not ashamed, because the love of God is shed abroad in our hearts by the Holy Ghost, which is given unto us. For when we were yet without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet peradventure for a good man some would even dare to die. But God commendeth his love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Much more then, being now justified by his blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him. For if, when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son, much more, being reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. And not only so, but we also joy in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom we have now received the atonement. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who is the figure of him that was to come. But not as the offense, so also is the free gift. For if through the offense of one many be dead, much more the grace of God and the gift by grace, which is by one man, Jesus Christ, hath abounded unto many. And not as it was by one that sinned, so is the gift. For the judgment was by one to condemnation, but the free gift is of many offenses unto justification. For if by one man's offense death reigned by one, much more they which receive abundance of grace and of the gift of righteousness shall reign in life by one, Jesus Christ. Therefore, as by the offense of one, judgment came upon all men to condemnation, even so, by the righteousness of one, the free gift came upon all men unto justification of life. For as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous. Moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound, but where sin abounded, grace did much more abound, that as sin hath reigned unto death, even so might grace reign through righteousness unto eternal life by Jesus Christ our Lord.
Okay, it doesn't look like Jan's here tonight. Is he still having some problems? Do you know, Terry?
I'm called John tonight. I just got in. I couldn't get my name changed.
Oh, okay. How you doing, John? Any questions?
We do have one question, John. It's short.
Okay.
It says, my question is, you have talked in the past about how there is a lack of due process. Could you explain to those of us that are struggling to fully comprehend the importance of that and how the lack of due process is affecting we the people?
Well, due process is the unalienable right to be heard in a court of law. And a court of law is one that proceeds according to natural law. And, of course, that is by a trial by jury, 12 individuals, that are really brought through to the process that they understand that they have the unalienable right to decide innocence and guilt. They also have the right to decide what the law is or what the facts are. And also what the penalty should be, with an eye on restitution and not necessarily on jail time or anything of that nature. Of course, violent crimes is something else. But due process, we haven't received due process in the United States since at least 1938, when the Rules Enabling Act were, passed, and 1938 is when the Supreme Court actually brought forth their rules and changed our system from law to civil law. You know, the word law, I think I mentioned this, is that which proceeds according to the natural law. Civil law is the law of man, and that's what we've been under for quite some time. We're under an illusion thinking that we have unalienable rights in the courts and that the Bill of Rights stands. To some degree, you know, I guess they don't have too much of a choice to hide it very well on the, you know, on the Supreme Court side of things, you know, when you get up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Although, of course, they've made a lot of bad decisions in the past, but they also made a lot of good decisions, too. Due process, again, is that right to be heard in that court of law. We've got chancery courts is what's going on right now, which, again, more often than not, one man will make the decision, innocent, guilt, penalty, and so on. So that's what we're fighting for, as a matter of fact. And I think next week we might be able to look at the paper, which I don't think is going to be too much different than the original paper that we sent forward, that they've returned on us twice. But we're going to do it a little bit of a different way and see how we go with that. So if we can get it together by next Monday, you know, we'll share it. I don't know that we're going to be able to read the whole thing, but we'll read parts of it maybe. And we'll make it available for people to see, and we'll be filing it with the United States Supreme Court. And this is the very, very issue. The fact that they abrogated the law of the land and brought us into slavery, ultimately. I mean, they've done it economically to begin with. They've done it, in many, many different ways, now they've done it in the courts. So, anyway, that's where we're heading with, and that pretty much is due process, the right to be heard. Okay, in a court of justice. All right, that's the one and only question tonight, huh?
That's the only one I saw. Of course, I could come up with another one if you like. I do have something on my mind. And that is that I hear over and over again that common law is based on precedent. And I don't think that's right. I think that that's a fallacy that they trained on us in all the colleges. Once the rules of civil procedure and once the rules of criminal procedure were made into laws. So it is common law based on precedent. In other words, another court case came along and similar to the one that I'm in, and it says, oh, he should be found guilty. And so they say, okay, based upon that case finding, he should be found guilty, and that's the end of it. What do you think?
Yeah, well, again, that's what they're taught in law school. You know, it's called, what you're talking about is called comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, which is trial court decisions made into law. You know, there is a common law maxim that states, a thing similar is not necessarily the same thing. There's no such thing as a case exactly on this point to be ruled on another point, because again, it's just a little change and it changes everything. But besides that, that's only really, really they're just holding their own things up, and they've created a lot of problems on trial court decisions, and a lot of people just didn't have the money to go forward, or really the knowledge, or whatever the case may be, to continue to go forward to the appeal and the appellate process. So you get a court case that stands on trial court trial decisions, and again, they hold that as precedent. There are a lot of things that they hold as precedent. I can't think off the top of my head at the moment, but I've heard of some things that they've held as precedent, and I thought about the conclusion at that point that it doesn't make any sense, because just because something has been held for a long period of time doesn't make it right, and it trumps right, and that's what they do all the time. And they make things up as they go. But yeah, you can find cases. When I did think on those terms in the beginning, trying to figure things out, and I was going into courts making a case, and they'd quote cases, I'd go read their cases, and I'd find, hey, I can twist this case around and make it stand for our position or my position. So you can make things say whatever you want to say. You can find a case to make a position on anything. The bottom line is, cases are to be dealt with by the facts. I think it was Lincoln who said, give me the facts. I don't need anything else, and I'll try a case. Just give me the facts. And a case should always rest on the facts. The law really brings in justice. We're not talking men's law. We're not talking about codes and statutes and regulations. All those things are for the purpose for controlling people who work for government agencies or people working in commercial activities, which we gave them power and authority to do that under Article 1, I believe it was Section 8, Article 1, Section 8. But we never gave them any power or any authority to change our law from law to civil law. We never gave them any power or authority to do a lot of the things that they've been doing. And then the courts, of course, have taken the Rules Enabling Act is creating new power and giving it to somebody. So what happened was the legislators literally created a new power and without even consulting the people, and just gave that power to the United States Supreme Court, which then came out with their rules. And it's a major problem, because there is no justice in our courts. They're chancery courts, and status quo always wins, and that's the problem. And by the way, I don't think there's anybody in the queue. Let me take a quick look. Hang on a second. Oh, yeah, we do have a couple people in the queue. Good. All right, anybody
John,
wants
I have a question for you.
It's a 1 if anybody is on a phone. Star 6 and 1 if you're on a phone. If you're on an app or browser, should be a button. Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Thank you. And yes, another way to state it is that justice can only be had in individual circumstances. That's Brent Winner's quote. And it's just eloquent and true and right. And yeah, you can only have justice in individual circumstances. And if people understood what it meant to be a freeman, to have an individual, a member of the bar, judging you from their own conscience, that would make your blood boil. If you actually knew what your true heritage and history, it would make your blood boil, and it should make your blood boil. That they're judging us, it's disgusting and evil. It's the civil law, which of course is tyranny. But here's my question. May 4th is today, so in 1 month it's June 4th, and in 2 months it's July 4th, and I remember this talk from the past many years. Aren't we supposed to start, and earlier, the talk was earlier that we were supposed to start beforehand, but then it rested on July 4th, our 250th anniversary, that we're supposed to start a year-long celebration But this is a white hat notion. So do you know anything about this? And it's only 2 months away, so I mean, they better get busy if it's a real thing, or is it just more hopium? Can you answer this question?
Yeah, because Trump had made that point, and he wanted to, you know, really focus in on the 250th anniversary. And I've heard this, the very same thing you said. I don't know exactly what's in view. I think they're moving quite quickly now on a lot of indictments and different things. So, I mean, that in itself is a great gift to the Patriots, to anybody who is a true American, because these people have been working overtime for quite some time to destroy this nation. And literally actually, they've been working at this for 250 years. You know, nothing has changed, really. It's just, it's been, instead of out in the open, it's been covert. So, but going back to the other point concerning a jury and concerning law and a law of justice, you know, they even take hung juries. A hung jury is when some judge decides, well, this jury's not going to come up with a decision, so, you know, we're just going to have to retrial or something of that nature. You know, hung jury means that the person walks. If all 12 cannot come out in an agreement, they got to come at some point and say, you know, we got to find him, this person, not guilty, because they can't go any further. Now, the judge should send them back, but they have to conclude. At some point in time, they have to conclude. Also, I've seen where judges have taken a jury decision and overturn it and go for another trial. One of the trials that President Trump went through, the judge broke the jury into three different groups and said, this group will decide this group will decide that, and this group will decide this, different charges on Trump. I mean, that's how far out we have come to losing any kind of sense of justice in our courts. And again, you know, look at, the Bible says, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. And our God is the Lord through our courts, because he's the king of the court. You know, a jury trial, the jury represents the king. And so they represent the king and is supposed to come out and benefit the righteousness of the king as they see it. And of course, the king of our court is Jesus Christ. We are a Christian nation. But they've turned everything around, and they've taken God's law and replaced it with man's law. And again, that is the purpose of what we're doing here, heading into the Supreme Court. And like I said, next Monday, hopefully, we'll have the papers to share, and we're going to file them and see once where we go with them. I've been thinking a lot of trying to go up through the trial court system, and I just can't really fathom a way. I can't think of a way to really do this. It's kind of strange to, you know, to take a presentment and try to take it through a trial court. But, you know, we're going to go. There is a clerk, the main clerk. I forget what the title would be, but, you know, the clerk for the United States Supreme Court. Everyone else is sort of a, you know, like it's almost like the sheriff and the deputy. You know, the deputy clerks, clerks, I guess you might say. Maybe that's a good phrase. But we're going to send these papers directly to the chief clerk of the United States Supreme Court for filing the presentment. And if anybody is not aware of our presentment, you can find some information on the front page here. Let's see, grand jury presentment to the United States Supreme Court, for anybody that can see the desktop here. You can click on watch the video concerning the grand jury's presentment to the United States Supreme Court. And if you want to attach an affidavit to our papers, you know, we're looking for people to do that. We've got a lot of cases, hundreds of cases that we're going to refer to through the process of taking this up through the Supreme Court. And we've got some affidavits we've been collecting. If anybody wants to, there's instructions on the affidavit. We're looking for a one-page affidavit, no more than one page. There's been a couple of people who sent in a couple of pages, but really it should be one page. You can't try the case in this case. You really, and once you start talking about your case, you then just make the case that the United States Supreme Court can't hear it, okay? Because depending on the issues, they can't hear the issues. They can only hear the violations. Your violations of whatever rights you're claiming that they have violated, and the right of due process. Really, everybody has been violated by their due process, because they don't get due process. You can't get due process by a statute to begin with. There is no due process there. And you can't get due process from a court that, again, is operating from a whole different position. They're outside of justice. They're not operating with the law. They're operating under what's called chancery courts. You know, unfortunately, by the time the Constitution came to be, you know, and you can read about this in the Federalist Papers, they were looking at the different courts that were already in the colonies. And the main court focus, of course, was the common law court. But there were chancery courts already being practiced in many places in the colonies during the time when they put the Constitution together and the Bill of Rights. There is a lot of correction that really needs to be made, and I don't think that's ever disappeared, especially as you go out west. And I know there was a movement back then also, people who wanted to take the common law out west for the purpose of correcting the problems. And remember, the problems came into this into the colonies in 1750. The king sent in swarms of bar attorneys and barristers, and the purpose was to destroy our courts of law. They wanted to bring them into courts of chancery, bring us under civil law, and destroy our common law. And that has never stopped. The Revolutionary War really never ended. It's ending with Trump right now, for anybody paying attention and understands, England alone is one of our biggest problems. Anybody else have a question before we go forward? Otherwise, we're going to go to the questions at hand here. Oh, going back to the affidavit, we're asking people if they're going to want to put an affidavit in here, mail it. We give an address up here. And mail it with a donation. We do need some money, so whatever you can afford. Okay, let's see who's in the queue. Okay, Linda from Virginia, it looks like. You got the mic, should be open. Go right ahead.
Good evening.
How you doing?
Okay, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Okay, well, I just called to give an update. I have the consumer entrapment situation,
mm-hmm.
and tried to buy a furnace and, became ensnared in just with a bunch of predators. And so within 4 days of this happening, I canceled the contract and told them to come and remove the system. So after that, everything was in writing, nothing verbal. So when I would contact them about removing the system, they would respond and say they're going to remove the system, but that I needed to sign some documents. And at first, the first time I said, no, I will not be signing any further documents. The next time, I said, send me the document. And it turned out to be an entire page of hold harmless and non-disclosure
mm-hmm.
agreements. And I, So that's when I did the notice and demand, and I served, there's four parties, the finance company, the parent company, the local installer, and another possible sub company. So I served, by sheriff, I served the parent company and the finance company, because they're the major players. And then I certify mailed the local installer and the other sub company. So I got back.
Everybody involved has been paid then by this loan that they created, correct?
I guess so. I assume so. I don't have proof.
You should ask very specifically if they've been paid. Just ask them the question. They're just going to dig themselves deeper if they lie.
Oh,
absolutely, because it's fraud. They can't be paid without your signature on that check, period.
So the loan is with the finance company, and the finance company would have paid, somehow paid the parent company and the installer?
No, the finance company has to put a two-party check out to the person, which would be you, which would be the client, the person having the work done, and then the contractor. And this way, that's the lawful way to do it, because you can prevent, if this person doesn't do things correctly according to your desires, if you see problems or things that are incomplete, you just don't sign the check. Just hold the check until, hey.
Well, I can tell you for sure that wasn't done.
Of course.
There was no check anywhere.
We spoke about that already, and we established that. That's why I'm bringing that point up. You see, the other thing is, generally, usually, they don't usually give all the money up front. I mean, this is a, it's just one item. It's not like building a house or anything like that. And it is installing is it an HVAC system or just a heating system? Whichever
it was. Air conditioner and furnace.
Okay. So, again, it's something, it's not really a big job. In the sense, like when you put it up,
right? It's like delivering a refrigerator, really. I mean, there's more to it. There's more to it than that, but it's not much more than that.
It's a day or two's worth of work, depending on how much work they have to do on the ventilation side of things. But
they didn't do any. They didn't do any vent work or anything like that. They did have to run the high voltage wire from the electrical box to the furnace. Yeah.
So anyway, one day's job.
It was like half a day.
But my point is this: is you go ask the question, and I would start with the finance people. Did you send a check into the contractor? And if you did, was it a two-party check? Just ask them the question. They may turn and say to you, "Yeah, we did, and it was a two-party check," but it should have really been sent to you, not to the contractor. Now, and that's at least here in New York, that's the law. I mean, all these insurance companies or finance companies or whatever, it goes to the person who's taken out the loan, and it's up to them.
Yeah, it's like you as a person that is going to pay for it has been edited out of the process.
Right. Well,
completely.
You might find that your signature is on that check, and it's not your signature. So anyway, I would look into that.
Oh, my signature was copy and pasted on all the documents, but that's
right.
Update, I'm in the 30-day period that I gave them, and I got proof of service back from both the finance company in San Francisco and the parent company in Memphis, Tennessee. I got both the proof of services back. So that's good. And so I'm in the 30-day waiting for their response. But a day or so ago, I got a response back from the local installer, the local company. I call it the local front company.
Yeah, the contractor.
So anyway, what they're doing, and this is what they've done all along, whenever I tried to get them to establish a day to come and remove the system, they would basically come back and they'd say, we've been trying to get a hold of you, but we haven't been able to. They make a big deal out of trying to make it look like I'm not responding, or, you know. So they do that, and then they say, we need you to sign some papers. And then it turns out to be the hold harmless and non-disclosure statements. So in the demand letter, I cited them for extortion, because they have no leverage to require a non-disclosure or hold harmless. You know what it is? They've got a canned process that they do for just every account, and they just follow that, and they never really look at the circumstance, you know what I mean, the individual circumstances of the what's really happening. But anyway, so that's what they do every time, is they make it look like I am being dragging my feet, or, you know, delaying or whatever.
All right, well, going to do once you get to the end of the 30 days, because, you know, you have to make a move after that.
Well, that's why I'm calling you.
Okay. Well, you know, I've been telling you that.
No, my understanding is I do a default.
Well, you go into
right?
the default, but you have to know how to file the papers in the court, and, you know, unless you're going to have to get a lawyer, and you don't want to get a lawyer and pay a lawyer. I don't think it's worth it. Nevertheless,
well, if there's a contingency lawyer or a no-fee lawyer, I might consider that.
You're probably not going to find that, but maybe, I don't know. Again, if you can prove fraud, then the whole thing becomes a whole different subject matter. That's why
some people see this all ties back into that whole mess with the solar industry. And some people have found contingency lawyers.
Yeah, well, if you think you could find one, that's fine. But the bottom line is there's no big money here. Again, if you were suing them for a large amount of money because of fraud, okay, well, that may give you a whole different possibility there.
Yes, may be the problem, is there's not enough money to be gained from this, situation.
You don't want to spend money that you're going to lose because, you know, again, you know, you're losing the money that you're spending to pay a lawyer, okay? But the thing is this is why you're going to want to now, after your 30 days, well, actually, you could do this now. You can call up the finance company, and you could send them just a letter if you want, and demand an answer that the question is have they paid someone, and how much did they pay, and who was the check made out to, okay? And then you could also ask the question to the contractor, the same thing: have you been paid? How much was the amount? And whose name was on the check? Those are the questions that's probably going to end up being fraud, I think, because again, I don't know how things work in Virginia, but here in New York, it's pretty much the same everywhere, I would imagine, because it makes sense. You don't just give a check to a contractor and. You know, you have to have the customer has to be happy with the work, and it's in their hands to give that check over, okay? And again, you have no papers signed. All right, so we'll see what happens after the 30 days, but if you're going to take it into the court yourself, you have to learn how to do this. So you have to learn how to file papers in the court. You want to move for a default on the notice and demand, the fact that they didn't answer. And you said one group did answer. Did they answer in writing? What did they say?
Well, that's what they said. They tried to make it look like I am not responding. I have been trying to reach you regarding the removal of your HVAC at my address. The enclosed release and settlement will need to be signed to schedule the removal. See, they've got me in a catch-22, in a hold hostage.
They don't have you in a catch-22. You can make your own paper up and sign it. I give you permission to remove this from my home, blah, blah, whatever you want to write that you want them to do, and here's my permission and here's my signature, and then mail them a copy. Let me think about this a minute.
I have responded with that. I said, that just tell me the date and the time, and I never can get a date and time from them.
No. Listen.
But it says, this is what it says.
Now,
Hold on.
What you want to do here is this. It's very simple. You want to write the letter that is the permission for them to come in and take the furnace. That's what you want to write, and you want to sign it.
Okay.
You want to get it notarized. You want to get at least two copies, and one original you always keep yourself, but you can give them the other original, or you can hold the other original for court and just give them a copy, because you're probably going to end up in court. But I don't think so. I think if you sign it and send it to them, they're going to take it out, because I think the fraud is there, and that's the problem. Now the other thing is this. By removing it, you got to get a release from this loan that they set up from you. You have to find out from the finance company.
Let me read you the rest of this. It says, once the unit is removed, we will refund your Good Leap financing $12,892.
Okay.
Anything you have paid to Good Leap would then be refunded by Good Leap.
Okay, so.
And then they go into, after multiple attempts, we don't hear from you. And
hey, listen, write up the paper with the information they want on it, and the information you don't want to write on it, don't write it on it. Just make look at it. It's you're getting back to a contract again. This is still part of it. You're having a debate going back and forth on an agreement, and an agreement is a contract. So if one way, without the meeting of the minds, there is no contract. Okay, that's the law. And so the meeting of the minds is that you're going to respond, well, you want this, but I'm not going to use this sentence, I'm not going to use that sentence, and I'm not going to use whatever it is that you don't want. And write it up, sign it, have it notarized when you sign it, and then mail it to them. And they should then say, give me a call. I don't want to spend too much more time because we've got people in the queue, but then you tell them that you give me a call and we'll set up a date for you to come out. You know, that's it. I wouldn't get too much involved.
Yeah, I always add that the contract was canceled in 4 days, and I requested them to remove the equipment. I always add that in there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's good too, because there is a certain, I don't know how many days. I know in New York there's a certain amount of days that when contract has to sit around before you have some time to think about it. And I think it's 3 days. So I don't remember.
When he made the visit, I asked him about cancellation, and he showed me
4 days.
It said, and this was kind of weird. It said that you could cancel within, I don't know, it was 3 or 4 days, but if you were over 65, you had 7 days.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of weird, but he did show me that.
The law is looking out for the elderly. I've never seen that, but that makes some sense, and that's what it is in Virginia, and that's fine.
I would say, but see, he never gave me the contract, and I would say that's one thing I haven't done. I have several copies, versions of the contract. One was when I filed the complaint with the Virginia SEC. The consumer protection here, they got me a copy of the contract. Mm-hmm. And then the CFPB required them to send a copy. So I got a copy from them, going through this, filing a complaint with the CFPB. So I've got two contract versions, and I need to take a look. I need to go over those and, because I suspect that they have been changed from what I initially saw.
Well, again, you got to wait till the end of the 30 days, see where it goes, but you have to decide what you're going to do. If you're going to go into court, you have to know how to go into court. And this
I've been in court. I've represented myself.
You know, write the papers. So. That's key. But you remember, you're moving for a default.
I've written pleadings and counter suits.
listen, they probably will not give you the default. There's a good possibility they could, but look, they probably won't because they're lawyers, and lawyers don't recognize notice and demands. They don't want to recognize notice and demands.
If you file a default, who gives it to you? The judge, or that they give it to you?
Well, you have to move to court for the default. And if there's significant amount of evidence to lean on your side, that
I think there will be. They forged my signatures on the second.
You asked. I don't want to go into all those details because that's something. If you do go to court, that you're going to battle. But the bottom line, if you had to go to court, you push a default. You move into court for a default because you've already went through the process of serving them the notice and demand, which is just as valid as the original papers as a summons. So the thing is because we're dealing with bar attorneys, a lot of these people don't understand. They're not taught this kind of thing. It is a common law procedure and process. So, again, it's not something that they're familiar with. But that's okay, because then you can just send the new process to the courts. You go through a time. You have to do the summons. You have to do, and again, even for a notice and demand, you still have to do the summons. But then you have to move it for a default. But again, once that's served and you move for default, the judge may give it to you and may not. And again, if you're going to ask for a trial by jury, I don't see there's a reason for that. But not that I trust judges, but I don't trust lawyers either. But, to move it, again...
I'm wondering, though, when it gets to the court, should I... go pro se or not, because you basically only get one shot, and
there's two appellate processes. Once you go through the original trial, there's two appellate processes.
But it's very hard to get a case overturned.
But again,
not easy.
We're getting too much into too many things going on here. The bottom line is they seem to already agree they're going to take the furnace out.
That is one good thing. They have agreed repeatedly.
Will you listen? Okay. That in itself wins the case in court. Okay?
Right.
But I'll tell you right now, what you need to do is bring together the meeting of the minds. Take that paper and rewrite word for word everything in there that you like and skip the things you don't like, which is probably a couple of sentences, and then sign it in front of a notary, two copies, you keep one, send one to them, and then see where that goes. But with that, I got to move on because we've got people in the queue here. Okay?
All right. Thank you so much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, before we go to the next person here, Jen, I don't know if you had your computer here, but did we have someone that was coming on tonight to talk with us from another organization? Well, Terry, do you know anything about that? All right, well, let me go back to the queue then. We'll take the next person. Okay,
Yes, John. The fellow was in the queue here. Let me see. His name is Jerry.
Okay,
he's number two in the queue.
All right, let me take Jerry next, and then we'll get back. We got three people in the queue, and we'll take Jerry, and then we'll go back to the other two. Let me unmute him directly. Okay, Jerry, what state you from, and you got the mic.
Hey, you can hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. I'm not from a state. I'm from Alberta, Canada.
Okay.
And I talked to Jan quite a bit the other day there.
Maybe a state.
And explained to him. Pardon?
Maybe a state soon, I hear, huh? So go ahead.
Well, maybe. So anyway, I talked to Jan. I was explaining to him what we're up against in Alberta here. And it's basically they're holding a referendum for independence. And so what our group is doing is we're using a document called the Statute of Westminster, which was developed by the Parliament of BC, or the United Kingdom. And so it basically states that we're already sovereign. So what we want to do, because we know the referendum is not going to work. It's already being held up in the courts, and then they're going to tie it up as much as they can. So what we're doing is educating people, and we want to take Alberta back as an independent republic under natural law. So this is why there's a few of us on here tonight, I think. We just had a meeting before that. And so I've been on your site quite a bit, and we're just, we come on to see what we can learn and what you're doing. You're basically doing the same thing with the states, is taking the United States back to its original republic under natural law. Is that not right?
Well, pretty much a lot of that is Trump, is exactly what Trump is doing. What we're doing is making sure that our courts go back to courts of record again, natural law. One of the good things that you have, because you're connected, your roots go into the United Kingdom, and that brings you under the Magna Carta. So that should be very helpful also in your positioning. Now, when they were talking about what are they looking to do in the courts right now?
Well, they're holding a referendum. They just released today. They had 301,000 signatures.
And the referendum is to.
So a referendum is to have a vote on taking Alberta independent, but it is. But the de facto system, the courts and that, they're going to try to tie that up, because Alberta's the wealth province of Canada. Without Alberta, Canada, we hold 30% of the world's energy, so it's going to be pretty hard for Canada to survive without Alberta. So but the only way we can free the rest of Canada.
What kind of political?
Canada is by Alberta going into, it is political, but so anyway, we, come on the site to see what we can learn from what you're doing and the different things that you guys are doing.
Is there anybody in elected office that is pushing this forward also, like a governor or somebody? Is there a political movement that on with elected individuals also trying to make this move, or is it just the people on their own?
Well, we've got seems to be a pretty good premier that said that she will honor the vote. That's a citizens-led initiative on the vote. So this referendum will give us the vote coming up in October to decide if the people of Alberta want to go independent or not.
But now, who is giving that permission? You said someone's given permission that they'll let it go. What does that mean? Who is that person?
Well, it's the premier of the province. It's a citizens-led initiative to have a vote on independence, but she doesn't want independence per se as an individual province. It's a sovereignty within United Canada is what she's pushing.
I'm trying to understand the structure here now. Premier of Providence, I mean, what is that? Is that like a governor, or what is that?
Well, it's a premier of the province. Yeah, it would be like the same as the governor of the state.
Okay, all right, because that's very important, because if you have someone like that is leading this, I don't know. Look, here's the thing. You're free and independent, okay? You've been injured. You should study our Declaration of Independence and create your own to become independent. I guess you should go through this first, because you do want to make sure it's popular. And as long as it's popular, then you can make the move down another line. I don't see how the courts could get involved with this at that point. I mean, of course, they will try, and they will do everything they can, maybe, because they're politically motivated. The question is which way are they politically motivated? But the bottom line is if you can win on the votes of independence, then it's a matter, in my opinion, I would think you'd focus in on a Declaration of Independence. And again, you could look to our Declaration of Independence from the standpoint of why we separated you know, from Britain. And very quickly, you can start to list out the reasons and the problems and why you're separating, because, you know, it's unjust to begin with, and the people want to be free and independent. They don't want to be the supporters of the entire state of being of Canada, you know. Whatever it is that mm-hmm. you want to sit down, you should really sit down and make a list of these things of why, and get that going. You know, we did a video. I don't know. Did you see the video that we have on our front page concerning the grand jury presentment to the U.S. Supreme Court? And if you haven't,
I haven't watched it.
Okay, are you in on a phone or are you in on an app, a browser? Are you able to see the desktop?
I'm in on an app. I'm in on your app. Yep.
Okay, so you can see the desktop.
Yep.
Okay, right here under grand jury presentment to the U.S. Supreme Court, there's a video. Watch that video, because what that video does is it lays out all of the violations by the courts to the people that violating the people's unalienable rights and due process. Mm-hmm. And that'll give you, and then read our Declaration of Independence. Those two things, because we pretty much are following that rule also here, those mm-hmm. two things will give you some kind of a structure to write a paper. And create a real powerful paper, and if you do create a paper, you send me a copy. I'd like to look at it, and I'll give you my thoughts on it. And that's where I think you should go. Now, do you have a connection to this individual that is the Premier of Providence? What's that person's name? I think I've seen her.
Danielle Smith.
Danielle
Smith, yeah. She's been down to talk to Trump and Mar-a-Lago. And,
yeah, I've seen her on TV.
Just signed a pipeline deal into Wyoming. So, I mean, we think that she's on our side, but we've got the pressures of the federal government, which is an unelected official, Mark Carney, that's in there, which is not going to do much good for Canada. We don't believe it. Anyway, that's political. So,
well, she's got to be careful.
The other question I was going to ask. Yeah, very careful. The other question I was going to ask is the District of Columbia, when you read through the documents there, different documents in the District of Columbia, there, whenever it says United States, it always includes Canada. It always says United States and Canada. And it's never, you know, just wondering what that reasoning was.
Where do you read that? I'm not familiar where it says United States and Canada in what, as far as being North America?
It's District of Columbia documents that I was going through there. I don't have it up on my computer here, but...
That probably has something to do with being North America, and to be honest, I'm not too sure either concerning the statement or the frame being called District of Columbia. I need to look into that. But again, mm-hmm. North America, Canada is included in that, and that's probably mm-hmm. where the District of Columbia... So.
Yeah. Okay. I won't take up any more of your time, but I mean, I can get a hold of you if a person needs more information.
If you get a paper together or something, and you send it into mail at nationallibertyalliance.org, if I miss it, Jan will, I'm sure, make an attention to me. You know, get my attention to it. So.
Okay. Yeah, there's some other people on, so they may have a question in the queue too. So, yeah, so thank you very much for taking the question. Okay.
All right, well, I'm interested in hearing how these things are going up there. So, you know, give us some.
Trying to do the same thing as you are. So it's a North American thing that has to be done yet. So.
Well, again, if you get together with an idea of a paper, I can help you with that. Then, I mean, give you some thoughts and ideas.
Okay, for sure. Appreciate.
And again, when
sure,
you send,
appreciate it.
When you send anything to mail at nationallibertyalliance.org, you know, the leadership, everyone in the leadership gets it. So, okay, so I'm it'll come to my attention if I don't pick up on it myself. Okay?
Okay, sounds good. Okay, thanks a lot.
Alrighty. Okay, we'll take our next caller. Let's see if we'll go to... Anonymous, what's your first name and your state?
Yes, sir. Good evening, John. My name is Elizabeth. I'm in Arizona.
I recognize your voice.
I had a couple of questions, general questions. The first one is, when we go into common law, will we still have access to things that have been recorded, like in the states? You know, that I know they used to do it a lot more than they do now. Some, like when I was in California, I couldn't record anything unless it involved real estate. You know, but there was a time when you could record anything on the public record.
You can record anything on the public record right now.
Yeah, in some states you can, but in fact, some counties in Arizona won't do it either. They want it to involve real estate. That's just...
Yeah, but if it's something that you need to get into something, you know, you can always go to another county to do it. If it's...
Right.
That makes sense, though. You know, I don't know if that would make sense, and, you know, I don't know what exactly it is that you'd be trying to file that they would reject.
Right, right. Yeah, I just wondered about that. I agree. It should... They should all we should be able to record anything on public record.
Absolutely.
I just hope that when we switch over to common law, that those things will be preserved. You know, they won't be destroyed.
We have to fight for them because you'll get residual leftover. You look at getting what we're trying to get is just the beginning of what needs to be done. Now, we've already established the fact, and we've indicted, which sounds kind of crazy on the one hand, but there was no other way to go about it. We have done everything we could with these courts. Literally, we've spent, I don't know how many years, dealing with all these federal courts, and they've constantly maintained the status quo, throw us out of their courts, keep doing the same thing, ignore us, reject and deny our habeas corpuses, and you know all that is our proof. And the bottom line, and you know what? They don't even hide the fact that they've abrogated the law of the land. They've abrogated it. It's gone. It doesn't exist no more because they said so. That's why. And they got the guns. They hold the power and the authority in the courts. And there is the problem. But you see, if we can establish what we're trying to establish through the presentment, we've already set the stage by indicting the entire federal judiciary. We want them all gone, every single one of them. We don't want any bar attorneys to become judges in any of our courts. Now, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be educated. Of course they should be educated. I don't know that the bar is capable of giving a proper education because they're so deeply rooted into the lie because they created the lie. And look at they teach lawyers, A, that we are created, and you know what, if you go out to AI and you ask questions, you'll always get status quo in certain things that the deep state or the powers that be just don't want anything else out there but their lie. And but the bottom line is they teach these lawyers that we are created under Rome and that we're under Roman law and that we're established under Rome, and that nothing could be further from the truth, okay? And we're making that point in our papers that we were established under Israel, that we're a Christian nation, and that is clear as a bell going through our Founding Fathers' papers, reading through the Federalists, the Anti-Federalists, reading the papers and communications between themselves and the quotes, how they put together the Declaration of Independence and what the seal was to be that Jefferson and Jefferson and Franklin created the seals, and then they were rejected. And very interesting because the individual who rejected them was very much connected into the status quo of that day. You know, they were the enemy. And then they just put the seal off for a time, and then they came out with the eagle. Which is very interesting, you know, because there's a spiritual implication there also. But in any event, we got to go and get rid of bar attorneys. Now, you could take a bar attorney. They've got the knowledge of the process. They got the knowledge of the way things work, how due process works. They have a lot of knowledge Okay. But what they have to learn is to stop bringing up precedents, stop bringing up trial court decisions as common law, and go learn the common law. They can come here at National Liberty Alliance and learn the natural law, the common law, by taking our course, and or they can find it somewhere else. But they got to stop coming in under civil law and come in under natural law. And look at when you get into common law or natural law, and I try to use the word natural law more often than common law anymore, mostly because when you say the word common law, all these lawyers think, well, that means trial court decisions. That's what they believe common law is.
Okay.
And so I try to say natural law because natural law comes from God. You go to the Declaration of Independence for that. And any other law, civil law, comes from man. So legislative law comes from man. A law that is not legislated comes from God. Now, God's law comes from the heart, okay? God said he wrote his law into the hearts. So we know, everybody knows right from wrong, and that's why you get a 12-man jury. And that 12-person jury, okay, they have to come to an agreement. And the same thing set up, you know, this is a biblical position. It comes from the 12 apostles bearing witness to who Christ was, okay? That's the jury. Yeah, and it was unanimous. He was the Lord. He's the creator of the universe. Became a man to die for us, for our sins. So, again, you know, you have to establish, you know, the fact of what the jury is all about. But anyway, natural law is really very, very simple, okay? And you don't need statutes to and again, everything's about the facts. That's the key anyway. But yeah, the natural law is very, very simple. It's common sense with an eye on justice. That's it. That's the law. Nothing more, nothing less. That's it.
Yeah.
So, you know, any kind of a maxim that one would bring up would stand up in a court of law. And a maxim is something that nobody can argue with. You know, all men are created equal. That's a maxim, period, end of subject. You know, water can't run uphill unless you put a pump on it. You know, but water doesn't run uphill. That's a maxim. That's a truth. A thing similar is not necessarily the same thing. You know, there are thousands of maxims out there, and there's thousands and thousands of maxims to be founded yet. You know, and, you know, they're just founded through pure logic. Okay? Now, as far as written law, you know, which we the people are the lawmakers of the written law, we the people ordained and established the Constitution to control them. We gave them the certain powers and authorities we felt that they should have, and anything that we haven't given them, they don't have. So it's a pretty simple thing, really, when you think about it. It's nothing complex. What gets complex is statutes and you know, all these different statutes they write and regulations, which has nothing to do with us, nothing at all.
Okay, and I had, thank you. I understand what you're saying, and I just have another second question, if it's all right. So I've been doing some research on trying to understand bonds, and most of the stuff I find online is they're trying to sell a bond or telling you how to buy it, you know. And to me, it seems like it's a loan.
Like a U.S. bond?
No, like if you get bonded. You know, like the kind of bonds that the judge has and all the, you know, the officers have.
A bond is something that you go get to give it a position from a contractor's perspective, okay? You know, if we're going to go out and do some work in the streets, we're going to break up the street and we're going to put in water pipe or new drainage or whatever the case may be. Before you can bring any kind of, you know, of equipment in there to start breaking up the street, you have to be bonded, okay?
Yeah.
And that it's really like an insurance. You go out and you have to put up so much money or some kind of collateral backing to get your bond, okay? And so if anything goes wrong, okay, that collateral is there that could be seized upon. That's the key to the whole thing.
Right.
And judges are supposed to have bonds. The interesting thing is, and I see the problem with this also, because, you know, you have people that maybe go to be a judge or something or whatever the case may be, and they don't have the money for a bond. So that is a problem. But on the other hand, it becomes a different kind of a problem. Like here in New York, it took us over a year to run this down, where these bonds are at, who puts the bonds up, and where these oaths that are taken by these judges. And it turns up that everything is down in New York City, particularly in Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, which is the Southern District of New York, and everything is down there. And the main judges, or judgeship, whatever you want to call them, that are the authority with upon all the judges, okay, they're down there, and it's a small group of them, I think 6 or 7 of them together. And what we found out is that the people are really putting the bond up. So it comes out of the people's money through your taxes and things of that nature. That doesn't sound right.
No.
But on the other hand, I see the problem, and I don't know what the solution is for that.
Well, it seems like, okay, so if I'm a contractor and I have a bond and I do something that is incorrect and I have to access that bond to it's my word that it'll be covered, but then I have to pay it back myself, right?
If you know, well, yeah. So let's say it's not working necessarily that way, because you don't necessarily get a bond. You have insurance, of course, but you don't necessarily get a bond to cover you for an individual of the work that you're doing. Here's the thing. I bring this up only because of utilities. If you go to work out in a town on a road that's owned by the town, or a road that's owned by the village, or if you're working on a federal road, or whatever the case may be, okay, you have to put up a bond as a contractor before you break ground, okay? And then once you break ground, that bond sits there, and if anything goes wrong, the town will seize that bond, okay?
Uh-huh.
To go to court, you know, you can fight it in court and so on and so forth. You'll probably lose it if the town has seized the bond for a wrongdoing, you know, something that went bad, and you have to make sure it gets fixed. But they can hold that bond, and that bond is held, okay, until the job is done, and it's released at the end of the job. Now, again, same thing with a judge. A judge comes up and puts a bond up because they may do something wrong, and once they're no longer a judge, then that's released. But again, the way the bonds are set up, it sounds a little wrong that the people should have to put the money up.
I see. So seemingly, then, if like a judge has a bond and they have to seize it, individuals who have bonds, they have to pay that bond back, right? It's like a loan, really, more. But if it happens with a judge, they access the taxpayers' money to cover the bond. Is that what you're saying?
Here in New York, it is that way, and I don't know how it works anyplace else. It doesn't sound right on the one hand, but again, on the other hand, you get people who are running for a judgeship or to be a judge or whatever, and they may be just as poor as you and I are, you know? Now, if you're a general contractor and you're out breaking the road, you got the ability to set a bond up because you're not going to work on these on a town or village or federal road or anything like that without that bond. It's just part of the process. So
okay.
You build yourself up
to really get... It's really not so much an insurance the insurance... insurance covers it for you, but a bond, unless you're, part of the government or something, then they use taxpayers' money.
Yeah, insurance covers certain other things also. I mean, and not for the roads or anything of that nature, but it does cover a lot of different things, and there's lots of insurance. There's workman compensation, there's liability, and then there's the bonds.
Is there anything on the website that goes into that in detail about bonds?
No, I've never written anything up on that. There's not much to it anyway, unless you're into the contracting. But as far as, doing heavy construction, out there on the roads. But you could be doing a large contract and the general contractor or the developer, let's say, may require a bond. But that's a business that I'm familiar with, But again, I know what a bond is and the idea behind the bond. Same thing with a judge or any place else, that you have to have a bond, Same thing.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. I'll keep learning about that. I appreciate it.
Okay. All right. Anything else? That's it?
That's all for me. Thanks. Thanks, John.
Thank you. All right, we'll take our next caller. Let's see, we've got to go this way, then one more. Okay, Wayne, you got the mic right ahead. What state you're from, Wayne?
Hey, I'm from Oklahoma, John. Can
Wayne?
You hear me okay?
Wayne from Oklahoma. We got you.
Okay, good. I spoke to you about, I would say, a month ago. My case involves a divorce. It went for 9 years, and I finally started learning the law about 2024, went ahead and declared my, my sovereignty with the U.S. government, and gave them notice of that my jurisdiction is a real man living on the land, born in Texas, and I'm a Texan, okay? So
that's all not necessary, just so you understand. You're one of the people, and that's all you need to say.
And that's what I refer to in all my court documents. And I went ahead and went through your process of challenging jurisdiction, and, of course, they went into default after 10 days, and I gave them notice that I was going to remove myself based on violation of due process, and I did that. I went ahead and put the notice into the Northern District Federal Court of Oklahoma and filed for to make sure that I sued them. And the judge, I sued the two judges that were over my case over the 9 years, and also the defendant and her lawyer as well. So those are
You can't really sue the defendant in that case. You can sue the lawyer because the lawyer is a court officer. And, you know, which is very interesting because just what we were talking about before is the bond. That's the security that you can hit upon, you can seize on their bond. That's why they hide it, okay? But the thing is, but you don't want to just go outright and put a lien on a bond or something. You want to go through the process to deal with that bond. But the thing is that your judge will tell you that he or she is sovereign, and you can't hold me accountable for nothing. And this is something that they've built precedence for a long time. But when you go right down to the bottom line and the truth of the matter and Supreme Court rulings and the law itself, they are liable. The moment they step outside of their jurisdiction, they become liable. And that's why when you challenge the jurisdiction, A, jurisdiction must be decided. That's the law once you challenge it. And a judge stepping up and saying, well, I decided I have jurisdiction, that's not being decided. A case that is decided when you challenge the jurisdiction, then the prosecutor on the other side of the case, they're the ones that have to then come up and rebut your paperwork. And then the judge can look at it and decide it. But that judge in, like, let's take traffic court, they already believe they have jurisdiction, and they're never going to decide on your side. But then there's an appeal process you can go through, of course. But they never go through the actual hearing because they can't rebut the papers. You know, if you followed the papers that I had written, and you can create your own, you can add to it, take it away, whatever you want. But generally speaking...
Well, I followed you exactly to the T. And they were silent, okay? Yeah. So after the 10 days, which was on February 20th, I went ahead and cited them violation of due process and gave them an order for removal. And I opened up a Superior Court of record.
Let's stop for a second. Okay, so you're pushing for a removal, and if you get a removal, then you're happy at that point?
Well, I've been abused a lot.
Well, then that's where part of the process should be. If you're looking for compensation, okay, then you should give a value inside cease and desist, and you should be looking for damages for as far as compensation is concerned. Make the statement of what that might be, you know. Right now, my thinking is $500 in real money, and then you define real money in a footnote right there in that real money. What you call real money, here's the footnote. This is what it means. And you define it, you know, $500 face value. Silver, $500 of Morgan silver, 500 Morgan silver dollars face value. That's how I define.
Well, that's what I did. I did exactly what you did, okay, or at least what your papers showed. So and I went ahead and filed. Go ahead.
If you did that, then you move it to another court. And here again is another, these people just don't stop. It's all about money to these people. I've done this before, and I've moved it into the state court because you get an extra bite at the apple, so to speak, before I move it to the federal court. And because it's a denial of due process, you can go directly to the federal court. That's a violation of an unalienable right. But, you know, you go through the state first because if they deny it, you got two appellate processes through there. And then from there, you can then move it to the federal court. And you're adding more people to the lawsuit now because, again, they're denying you due process, too. And, again, so it becomes something that you could build up upon. But the thing is that, you know, when you go for the denial of due process, okay, going into a state court and you're looking for the bottom line solution, that's where the lawsuit takes place, okay? And it should be a slam dunk because, you know, you've gone through all the process, you filed in the your papers telling them that this is a denial of due process, and then you made the point maybe that due process must be, once challenged, it must be decided. And so right there, they've lost, you know. It's a case on paper. Move it right up
and
the line.
And let me tell you what's went on. I went ahead and put it into the federal court, and one of the magistrates was assigned to the case, and he read through my default judgment or default affidavit and basically came back and said that I was trying to move the divorce hearing into their court in a federal court, which is not true at all. And I told him, I wrote him a what's called a coram nobis non judicius writ of error.
Yeah, they've abrogated that too, but a lot of judges don't realize that. What did he say about that when you put in a
I filed it last week on Friday, and I've yet to hear back from him, but there's about eight errors in his he's trying to remand me back to that county court where it's all statutory law and not
again, you know, here's the thing is if this is still in the divorce course that is a problem, okay? Because you're absolutely first of all, well, let's think about this a minute. You see, you've been there 9 years, you're saying?
Yes.
9 years. Have you lost a lot of money and a lot of things through this process?
Well, of course.
Yeah. You see, anybody out there that needs to go through a divorce, you want to settle it between the two, you know, your spouse. You definitely want to settle it there. And if you understand how things work and you can lay it out to your spouse, no matter how angry or whatever is going on between the two, okay, if you can get them to pay attention, to really consider the situation, that everything is going to go to the courts and the judge and the lawyers. Everything. You're going to be spending money like crazy. It just doesn't make sense. The process that is set up it's not a problem at all. You'll come to certain situations in a case where there has to be, or you have to make an argument, maybe one or two issues you might have to make an argument, but everything else is cut and dry, pretty simple. And even the argument that you might be making is probably can be settled by, the plan that they've already got laid out, at least to some degree. The problem on the other side, once lawyers get involved, they want to fight everything. Okay, so they love to get the people riled up. Yeah, we're going to go do this. We'll argue this and we'll win this. And you know, it just is eating up your money when you can just go and just deal with the problem, get it done with.
John, you're a great teacher, and I can tell you from reading all your stuff, I've applied it, and most of it's worked. The problem is my wife is a lawyer, okay? And that's the reason why I sued her as well. She is an officer of the court.
It's very hard to fight against a lawyer, but go ahead.
Yeah, and anyway, in the court that we were in, they went ahead and went forward, even though I told them that, you know, anything was moot after I was removed, because they did not prove that they had any jurisdiction over me. And matter of fact, I even gave a quo warranto to find out, you know, do they have actual authority? And they didn't supply any answer to that as well. So I put them on notice.
Just so you know, the judge is right in the sense that if there's any inkling of anything in your paperwork that suggests that he has to make any decision concerning the issues in that court, then they're not going to hear it. And that's why he said that to you. But what is it that you think that he's looking at that makes him think that you were moving any of the issues? You were just looking for the denial of due process.
Correct. And that's why I wrote the error, the writ of error, because they're telling me that I'm trying to move my divorce into a federal court, and I already know better than to do that, because when I submitted a mandamus back in the appellate court, they denied it because I did that. So I didn't want to do that a second time, and I made very specific attention to my paperwork to make sure that that did not happen again. So
what exactly is your spouse looking for?
Huh?
What is your spouse looking for? Ex-spouse, what are they looking for? Lots of money, or I mean, the house?
Oh, yeah. Wanting my private accounts for all my 401k, my IRAs, my, the house that we sold that went into escrow. She's wanting that half of the half that I am entitled to.
You know what you should go down to see the clerk of the court, and they have a packet there, okay, for people who want to run through a divorce without going through the court system. They set all the paper, and the courts just do the processing. They don't get involved at all, because if you're going to work it out with your spouse through the packets, and your spouse should know this because she's a lawyer, but in any event, they're looking for more than what they probably deserve, maybe. I don't know. But the bottom line is, if you go through that packet and sit down and read through it and look at the process, you'll recognize a lot of the things that they've done, but you'll see the process. Okay. How long were you married for instance, roughly?
Well, 32 years. But listen, they went through with a summary judgment anyway, even though I removed myself from the court. And, of course, the judge just awarded her everything. Okay, I'm still in a pending case in federal court with her as a defendant. And of course, the two judges and the prosecutor, if you want to call him a prosecutor, her attorney.
Yeah, this case is so deep. You've been involved so long, of course, 9 years ago, that's a long time ago. If I could have been involved, I don't know that I had the knowledge 9 years ago anyway of this. I mean, if I could have been given you some advice before you actually go through the system, things could have worked out quite differently. But the thing is you have to get the other side to work with you. And the other side, and she's not representing herself. She's hired a lawyer herself, right? Because they train lawyers. Right?
Yeah, her lawyer just sent me her bill for $24,000 today that I received.
Oh, yeah. Up high, yeah. $500 an hour or some crazy thing, whatever. But, look at, and you can argue that too. The thing is, there's so many arguments, and none of that would be necessary if two people just, no matter how much angry, well, first of all, you should always try to make a marriage work. I mean, that's the Christian thing to do. But when things happen and you've got a break and that's that, you got to come to common sense, and you got to get the person on the other side to come to some common sense to understand, let's try to sit down. Here's a process that the court uses. Let's go through that process. Why pay lawyers to do that? Because all they want to do is argue this, argue that, bill, and it doesn't get anywhere, and everybody loses money, and then there's nothing left for anybody. So, but the thing is again, that's the process anybody goes
through. Well, they're not recognizing my jurisdiction at all. okay? And that's just wrong. So there's not going to be any money that changes hands until the jurisdiction is understood. Well, I am a king in our system, and I have not provided them any kind of jurisdiction that would put me as something lower than a government entity. Okay, so I'm just wondering what's going to happen at this point. I have no idea.
Look, status quo is gonna really be the bottom line on this thing, and that's unfortunate for you. And again, you're so deep and long into this to try to unwind everything and try to repair it. I don't see a way to do that. A federal judge cannot hear the case, obviously. And you can move it into the again, what state are you in again? You're in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
New York. Our courts are called the Supreme Court. Okay, we have all those silly courts, you know, village courts, town courts, and all those things, and even the city court. But the courts that are courts of record here in New York State is a county court, is a court of record, and the Supreme Court. So we go directly into the Supreme Court, and in the Supreme Court you have two appellate processes above that. You can appeal, and then there's the appellate process. So there's two courts you can go through appealing it above the Supreme Court. Now, in the Supreme Court, which is they have the power to hear the cases, but I'll tell you got a lot of work to try to put that whole thing together to make your case into the Supreme Court to try to unwind certain things. And the only way you're going to really be able to do that, okay, is to go get that packet and sit down and go through the packet and see what the process is. And if you can apply and if you come to the understanding of that process, then you can apply that process in the Supreme Court, making your argument of this is unrighteous or this is that or the other thing. You know, family court, which I think it is the category that, you know, when you're going through, you know, breaking up a marriage at this point, you know, is not a court of record, because a court of record brings a jury in play, and that gives you another power by going into the state court, because you can appeal to the people. But in order to appeal to the people, you have to do and understand three things. Okay, you need to be able to understand the process through that packet. Take all of your problems, lay it out, and use the process that's in the packet. You have to know how to, navigate through the court system, the forms and how things work, and if discovery is necessary, and all this other stuff. Okay, again, and we teach.
So what you're telling me is the common law does not really apply to marriage, so they won't hear me in a jury? Under
common law, a jury is a common law procedure. You could take it to a jury.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get to.
Yeah, you demand a jury trial in the Supreme in your state court. What do they call your state court? In your county court, there's a court that's a state court that every county has that state court. What do they call it? I don't know what they call it in Oklahoma. Here in New York, we call it the Supreme Court. New York.
Well, this one's a district court of Rogers County.
Hey, that's a common law court right there, and you can know that for sure by going to your constitution, and then do a word search for a court of record. Okay.
Well, they're pulling up statutes to use against me.
That's civil law, yes, but you want to do a jury trial. You see, again, let me finish up to what I'm trying to say before.
Okay.
The other thing you're going to have knowledge of, because this is a little complicated for the people, okay? And so you have to give them visual and audio. You got to speak, you know. So you want to be able to do this with a PowerPoint to lay your case out. But you know, it seems 9 years of court. Wow, that's a lot of stuff that you're going to have to work out. You have to take each point, okay? and lay it out, each point, kind of put down on a piece of paper, make bullet points, and then you're going to expand on the meaning of those bullet points. But you're going to do bullet points, try to get all of these things together. You're going to want to go into that packet they give you for people who want to handle divorces on their own without having to go through the court system, no lawyers or anything. You come to agreements on your own, and you bring it into the court for certification of the conclusion, you know. So you have to create that case, but you have to know, you have to have the ability to make the court access and understand how due process works. Now, I don't know if you've taken our course on court access and the common law. Have you taken that course? Are you in that course?
That's how I learned to do what I've done, yes.
So you're already ahead of the game in the sense you're understanding, you're seeing the paperwork, you're seeing the forms, you see the mindset, you see the process, the procedure. All of this has to work around a jury. So now it's just a matter of taking the facts of the case and applying it to the packet that is the conclusions that have already been worked out. That's a logical...
Well, they denied me a jury. I mean, it was going to be a judge that actually was going to decide this if I didn't pull myself out.
That's a court not of record, right? You don't want that. You want a jury. And the only way you're going to get... You see, you could move. That particular court you're in, what are they calling it? They're calling it a family court, a divorce court?
It's a family court.
Yeah, family
court. It's an FD case, which is family domestic, is what they...
Okay, so a divorce is underneath its categories. But that is not a court of record. That is a chancery court. And again, you don't want to be in that. You just don't want to be in that. You could stay outside and not participate with any court, and just get the conclusion certified by the court itself, the agreement between you and your spouse. But you're beyond that. You have to be able to go back and take all of the facts and lay them out, point by point by point by point. Lay out what is right and just point by point alongside this. You want to do this on a PowerPoint, and you have to give it a lot of thought and preparation in order to do that.
In what court do I? Because I went ahead and filed another divorce, suing her in a county court that was just directly beside.
No, you want the district court that you talked about. They are the one that the...
Well, they're a district court as well. They're called Mays County District Court. They're all called district courts.
Okay, well, you want to go... Again, I don't know how other states work. My state seems very logical to me, but you want to get into what's called the state court, okay? Let me give you an example. The court of record in my county is the New York State Supreme Court... County of Dutchess. That's the state court. Okay, if I was in Orange County, it would be New York State Supreme Court, County of Orange. Okay, county of this, county of that. That's the state court. That's the court you want to be in. Okay, so whatever court that is that has its appearance in every single one of the counties within that state is the one you're looking at. Now, they do have county courts. And maybe the district court of that county, maybe that is the court that is the state court. Okay, but who is the overseer? You should be able to know, and a packet will tell you, if you go get that packet, what court is the overseer. It'll give you the name of the court, which may very well be the district court of Oklahoma County, of whatever county you're in, if that's how it's established, the name. But the thing is that you go in there and you demand a jury trial. And that's how you start.
They won't listen to
not this court.
You don't understand. They have, if they deny you, you sue them because that's a denial of due process, a right of a jury trial, the Seventh Amendment denial.
Yeah, and that's what I sued for in a federal court. Yep.
Well, again, you can sue for those things, but it does come down to the fact that the case continues somewhere. The case has got to go, and you should have gone straight into the state court. You know, I've learned to go to the state court first, and maybe that's a recent thing I'm thinking of, because I would automatically go to the federal court for denial of whatever rights are, but you get an extra bite at the apple, so to speak, if you go through the state first and then you can move it into the federal. And along the way, you're collecting other people who are denying you due process. But you really needn't look to settle this thing because it has to be settled somewhere, and that's why you want to go in with a jury trial and deal with it in that court. You're going to be thrown out of the federal court, no doubt about it. So I start moving towards the state court, which is the one court that would be the overseer of that family court, which whatever court that is the state court.
Wow. So even though they denied me due process, they're still going to throw me out. What a deal.
Well, federal court will, because they, first of all, whether that's right or wrong is one thing, okay? They're not going to want to hear it. I'll bet you dollars to donut you're rid of error, he's going to come back and say that doesn't exist no more. Because one of the federal rules is that, and I wrote the, where did we do this? We did this recently somewhere. I forget where we did this. We went through the different powers of the people, which were writ. Okay, one of the writ of power was a writ of error. By rule, they abrogated all those writs. So, like I said, we don't have a constitution no more. People don't understand that haven't been in the courts. They don't understand that. They think if anything ever happens in the future, they're going to be okay. You're not going to be okay because you don't have unalienable rights. You don't have the rights of the sovereign to be able to set forth certain writs, and the courts must respond to those writs appropriately. But they don't, and they won't. And that's why we're doing what we're doing on our end. So, but yeah, you can move your case into the state court, and you have to make the point. You can use the words court of record, but in the top, you want to put in big, bold letters, jury trial demanded. Okay, make it clear, because they play games with the court of record. Number one, except on the federal level, any state level, lawyers, they don't have a clue on the meaning of a court of record. They don't know what it means. They think that a court of record is a court that keeps a record. Well, all courts keep a record. But a court of record is defined in Black's Law, and it's defined in other dictionaries. You know, you can go to Bouvier's, you can find it there too. A court of record is that which proceeds according to the natural law or the common law.
Well, I put the five requirements in the laws of the case when I filed. So, you know, if they don't read that, how do you teach a magistrate his job?
Well, then that's problematic. Look, I got a case going in. I've been fighting this case for over 5 years. Let me think how long I've been fighting this case. 6 years. 6 years. It's a Social Security case, okay? And I had to go through administrative judges because, well, it's the process, it's the procedure. I don't have a problem with it because the statutes, you know, is applicable to my position. You know, it works to support me, so I'd go through that process. Problem is they don't read. That is the big problem. They don't read. They're lazy. As lazy as the lawyers are, they're lazy, these judges, these administrative judges particularly. I mean, sometimes you'll probably get a judge who's interested and does read, and they like to read, but a lot of these people don't. I've been before three judges, and all three of these judges had to come back into a whole new case, write the whole thing back up again, and they keep ruling on the wrong thing, ruling on whether this person that I'm representing, whether they are, whether they are disabled to be able to get this. But that's not what the case is, because that's already been settled. But they just don't read, okay? And because the case had went up before, they read what went on in the other case in the decision, and they rule accordingly the same way. It's the same thing. So I filed it into federal court. I just moved it into federal court. I had enough of this. And when I went into federal court, I got a call back from somebody that gives advice to people who are coming in pro se, and they said, look, take one more bite, go back into the administrative court, and if you don't get satisfaction, then come back here. And I agreed to that. So they wrote up a paper. Okay, that judge wrote up a paper, and was very specific on what the case was about. and it was 3 points, okay? So I filed the papers, and then they turned around and they sent me papers telling me, okay, the hearing is going to be in July. I think it's July 17th, whatever it is. So we're going to be in hearing in July. And then they put in the paper that they sent me what the case is about, okay? And they do at least say in that paper that if this is incorrect, you must respond immediately. Apparently, they didn't even read the judge's paper from the federal court. The federal judiciary. They didn't read the papers. If they read the papers, they would have came to the point where there's 3 points of potential decisions, and that's what is being sent to make the decision on A, B, or C, okay? And they were doing, again, on whether the person was qualified for, to get the Social Security for the purpose of a disability, which they've already been on for 7 years. Well, not 7 years. Let's see. 5 years, I guess. We're looking for back payments. So the thing is, they don't read. They just don't read. And that's a problem. So you have a valid problem there. So I don't know.
Well, they move for summary judgment in this lower court. And according to FRCP Rule 58B2, they, since I brought up jurisdiction challenge and halted everything 15 days before they did that, I'm supposed to have 150 days to do a appellate or to bring it into a different court and overthrow the decision if they would do that.
Look, that gives you time. Once jurisdiction is challenged, it must be decided. So you have to have the day in court to decide jurisdiction. And that period of time could be so many months or whatever the case may be. Well, that's good for your side because now you could be preparing for the state court knowing what the end result's going to be. Okay, the end result is going to be they're going to deny what you're saying because they're going to maintain status quo. And they don't know what else to do with that. And that's fine because you now have prepared, you've got the knowledge, you've been working on the knowledge, you have to really work on putting this thing together, start with bullet points and work through your case and then work through the normal logical conclusions that you find in the packet, which is very logical. I'm telling you, I was very surprised to see how logical and righteous it sounded. So, and you go through that whole thing and then you can undo the spaghetti, so to speak, that's been taking place these past 9 years. You're going to find you're going to lose some and you're going to win some of these points. But at least you'll get to the point with a conclusion and you don't lose everything. That's the key. So continue start working with PowerPoint. You've got to have PowerPoint if you're going to go before a jury. You really got to be able to lay this out and visually.
Well, I just got to figure out what court to go into. That's a state court, and how to get there. That I guess that's my next step.
Go get the packet, and in the packet, it's going to tell you where the appellate for them is, which is the state court. In other words, if you have, it'll say right there. I'm going to, this is not the wording, but I'm just giving you some what it basically does say. If you're not getting satisfaction in this court and you want to challenge it, you can move it into this court. This court that they're talking about is the state court. Because they're the overseer of that family court.
And the court clerk will have that package.
Oh, yeah. Go up to the court clerk and ask for that package. If they don't have it, they'll tell you where to get it. You probably could even download it online. I mean, I went and I got a whole folder, and so if I have to do another divorce case, I could, I've got all that packet and everything, all the information. It's a pretty simple process. It really is.
Hmm.
Okay, we can go. We're out of time. We've got another person here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll take our next and looks like a last caller, Brett. Got the mic. I know we spoke before. What state you're from?
Yeah, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, I was just wondering if when you're putting a case together, does it have to be one case, or can you take a few case numbers and put them together if they're related, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to know the situation and the details and think about it and see once whether that makes sense or not.
Okay.
I'm
for,
the, lawsuit against two different organizations. One is the Southern Poverty Law Center, and then there's another one. I forget the name of the other one. Both of them are lawyer organizations, and I'm going to be suing both of them together in the same case.
Okay, so like,
what's going on with the Southern Poverty Law Center is really a good thing for me. That's why I'm deciding. I've already done notice and demand to these people years ago, and they just ignore everything, just like all the other lawyers do. But the thing is that only because what's going on in the court system right now, that they've indicted the Southern Poverty Law Center, that it kind of gives me, it's a time to be able to write this paper and potentially win it, even in the atmosphere of what's going on. But even if I lose it, I got appellate processes, and by the time I go through appellate processes, I should hope that we're going to have our courts of law back, if we can be successful. But we're only going to be successful as much as the people want us to be successful. People have to get behind this case. Mm-hmm. So let me make a note right now. I mentioned it earlier. We'll be talking about this case next Monday. But go ahead.
So in one interaction, one receives two or three citations, and they have different case numbers, but could that be a part of the same case, or do each one of them have to be individually contested?
Well, if there's a relationship that threads them together, then, if you go into a court and you sue and you don't bring in a necessary party, the other side can turn and say that because you don't have that necessary party, I want this case to be thrown out, and they can push the courts to have the case thrown out because the court case can't go further without that necessary party. So if it's linked in that way, definitely you can pull them together. I don't know. It's kind of, how you would do it. I don't know how you would do it. You'd have to go and talk with the clerk about that and say, look, I got these three cases. I want to consolidate them to one. But you want to sit down and write the case to see if you can consolidate it. Does it make sense to consolidate it? And why are you thinking to consolidate it? Can you give me an idea of the what each of the three cases are about in just a few words? Give me
kind
of bullet
traffic.
Point.
Traffic, how citations are really vague.
They're all traffic court cases?
Yeah.
Okay. Traffic court cases, and you're going through three of them. You could move them into federal court, and for cause, because of denial of due process, you can't get due process to a statute. That's number one. Number two, it's a statutory court, and therefore it is also operating under chancery. Has nothing to do with you or me or any of the people. Now it's an argument it's an uphill battle. Let's put it that way. I would do them individually, though. I don't know, because they're three different incidents, right? All in the same court?
It was all in one stop.
So why do you have three court cases going on then?
They're citations.
So you got three tickets in one court?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's not a big deal. Again, you can they gave you a denial of due process. First order of business is challenge a jurisdiction. When you don't get a response from them after 30 days, you do a default. Then they're going to try to push you to come back into the court, and then you move it to the federal court for cause for denial of due process, and you sue the prosecutor, and you sue the judge for denial of due process, and I covered this whole thing in our course, but we do cover this. I don't know how much knowledge you have on how the court system works if you don't have much at all, you're going to want to take the course or find someplace else to take a course. But we do it from the common law perspective. The other thing is, if you have knowledge, okay, you can go to Education Starts Here, and you can come down to Law, and you can come over then to Court Forms and Process, and then you can read through here, let's see, moving a case into demand for oaths, common law trust, forms, here's traffic court, okay, you know, appearance ticket. You know, I go through the whole thing. I create a file on demand, and I put that on top of it, and I do an appearance ticket, and I do a notice of motion, you know, I challenge the jurisdiction, verify jurisdictional challenge. Okay, then the judge is going to make a move on that and say, I decided we have jurisdiction. Then you're going to write a paper denying that and say, wait a second, there was never a hearing. And if you made a decision on papers, I win because I'm the only one who filed the paper. My affidavit rules this court. You know, an affidavit unrebutted rules the court. That's the point you got to make. And because the prosecutor didn't rebut your paper. And they can't rebut your paper. It's too powerful. You know, I've already laid that out, and you read through it. It's too powerful. They can't rebut it. So you win either way, but they're not going to let you out. They're going to want to keep you in that court. So then at that point, that's when you move the case for cause to the federal court. Now, you might want to move it to the state court first, because you got a couple of processes you can go through there. And you can also collect more lawsuits against individuals who deny you due process, other judges, as you go up the line, if that's what they're going to do, and then move it all into federal court. Or you can just move it directly into federal court. But again, we did a course. Are you familiar with our course?
Yes, I took the course. I just...
Access in the common law?
Yeah, it's just when some things pop into my head, I don't have like a tab to like go straight to it. So
I would
kind of get lost. But
you know, when I first put this course out, I suggested to people, and I think I wrote this suggestion up. I got to take a check. I did a book called Court Access in the Common Law, and that also is very helpful. You get some things in there that isn't in the course, and vice versa. You know, it's a pretty It's only about $39, I think it's $39, and it's 550 pages, so it's a huge book. It's maxed out on the page numbers. It's hardcover, 8.5 by 11, size of, you know, regular paper, copy paper, and it's in 10 fonts, so we're looking at a huge amount of information here, and it does a lot of forms and different things, And there's a different way you can comprehend a little better, maybe this way or that way, but it does work together. The only difference is I wrote the book first, and so the perspective I came through writing the book was one way, but when I just put together an actual course, it's a little bit of an alteration in what I started first with and as I went through, because I was more of a teaching mode there in opposed to a factual laying out of how things work. But it doesn't matter necessarily because, you know, you still have the same, it just may be different chapters, okay? You still have the essentials, which is chapter one. You have the anatomy of a court case, which is chapter two. You have the Republic, law and equity, which is chapter three. The two courts is chapter four. Jurisdiction and sovereignty is chapter five. You have causes of action, chapter six, case examples and strategies and mindset, chapter seven. There may be just different chapters in the course, so still the titles work, and you can just work off the titles instead of the chapter numbers. Then you have chapter eight, which is affirmative defenses. You have chapter nine, which is punitive damages, 10 motions and examples, 11 Supreme Court rulings, statutes and rules, chapter 12, ready for trial. And it goes through all kinds of things there with objections, applicable, all kinds of things in that. Then chapter 13 is memorandums. Chapter 13A is a special focus on the IRS. Chapter 14 is extraordinary writs, and a lot of them have been abrogated by the federal rules of procedure, which is a violation. That's a violation of law. That is ultimately it's. null and void. Then there's the rules of common law, the right to practice law, the notice and demand, the jury, the maxims. I mean, this book covers a lot of stuff, and it may be helpful to have it in book form. The other thing is I did another book, and these are very small books. They're very inexpensive, under $10. One is Understanding the Federal Courts. If you're going to go into federal court, you should understand how they're structured. And it's not a big book at all. It's, it's about 110 pages, roughly. And then the final one, which I wrote this for myself, and then I published it, which is a common law court handbook. And this is being able to pull things off the fly while you're in court, okay? And I find I created this because I found it helpful to be able to pull these things off the fly, you know. And again, I put it together in a logical form that makes sense to me. But I would definitely suggest get the book Court Access and the Common Law book also. I think it'll also help in many ways. And it's just a different way of seeing things. And the forms are automatically right there on the pages, you know, as you're moving through learning the procedure. And so I know you're taking the course, and for those who might be interested, that course, I think we charge $125. Learning due process in college will cost you maybe upward of $12,000-$13,000. And they got a 60-hour course. Our course is a 90-hour course. But you're on the right road with learning on this.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, is that it? Well, we've come to 11 o'clock anyway, so Eastern time. All right, with that, that's it for the night, I guess. And next week we're going to talk, hopefully we're going to talk about the court case that we're filing. And it's not a court case. It's a presentment to the United States Supreme Court. And I'll try to articulate the strategy I'm thinking, and a backup strategy also, maybe. And we'll somewhat go through the papers. I don't know, I'm not going to be able to read through the whole thing, but maybe some highlighted pages, and we'll post a copy of that up onto the website, and people will be able to download it and read it and hopefully share it as much as possible. You know, we're not going to win this case without people behind us. The key is the people. So we need people behind us. We need people getting this word out, getting people to look at the video on our front page. Let me go back to the front page here. Getting to look at this video on the front page, which is concerning the grand jury's presentment to the United States Supreme Court. Right here. So, okay, with that, we're going to end the call for tonight. Thanks for coming. Lord willing, we'll see you all next week, Monday. Good night.